This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Wayne Holden was not born a natural athlete, but he was 6'6" in high school, and there was no escaping basketball. He learned to play and play well, got him a full ride to college, where he learned to build a team and to lead. And that experience pointed him toward psychology. After getting his PhD, went to work with troubled kids, then went into academia, and his frustration with the culture of the academy led him into the world of independent research. And today, he is the CEO of RTI International. It's an international research organization with more than 4,000 employees worldwide. He's famously good at his job, and if you ask him why, he'll go back to the beginning, learning to work with what he had and being tall, playing basketball. Wayne Holden's journey is a fascinating one. He joins me to tell us more about it on The State of Things. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
You're a psychologist, and now you're head of a large, essentially a corporation. It's a research firm. It's a big 4,000 people. What is your motivation? What drives you to do what you do, to get where you are?
Well, you know, I think the two pieces of it that are most important is that given who I am and the experience I've been through in my life, especially when I was a kid as an athlete, I'm pretty competitive and pretty goal-oriented. But what the other piece of it that kind of gets mixed with that that I think makes me effective is that I'm also very sensitive to other people and how to work with other people. And that's not so much a God-given talent as it is acquired through training and the experiences I had as a psychologist.
Well, let's go back to some of the even earlier experiences, those days in high school playing basketball. I was never 6'6", but I was relatively tall. And I'll be honest, I did not want to play basketball, and they made me.
Well, I when I was 14 years old, I probably couldn't walk and chew bubblegum very well. At that point, I think I was about 6'2 or 6'3 and kind of got drafted into playing basketball and started out with being on the, you know, one of the reserves who sat on the bench and actually got some interesting criticism from people periodically because I was one of the tallest people on the team. What happened through a lot of hard work and a lot of guidance and support from other people, coaches, other teammates, things like that. My senior year in high school, we ended up going all the way to the state championship, lost that by 7 points in South Carolina. And all five of the starters on that team, and I was one of the starters, ended up getting scholarships to college.
And that team wasn't very good when you 4 years earlier, when you were freshman.
No.
Was this one of these kind of cinematic, you know, endings to the great sports story, the lowly team that makes it all the way to the finals?
The team there was not that good. The coach there worked with the younger guys, saw the promise. We all worked really hard, got to that point, did pretty well. Interestingly enough, when I went to college, I went to a small college in South Carolina. I went from the state championship team to a team that I think our first year was 5-20 in terms of our record.
Wow.
So I kind of had to deal with the stresses of getting to the top of the pinnacle and then kind of moving on but starting at the bottom again.
Well, when did it occur to you that you might get a scholarship and that might be the way you were going to go to college?
It was my senior year in high school when I really started realizing that, you know, I had college coaches come and talk to me after games and realizing that I was being recruited and that I'd be able to have that opportunity. I came from a background where we didn't have a lot of resources in our family, so it would have been difficult for me to be able to finish a four-year university degree without some sort of help, whether it was academic or athletic.
But your parents were determined to send you to your brothers and sisters. Yeah. That was a big goal of theirs.
And it's an important issue in my background. My father went to high school for 1 week and dropped out in the 9th grade. My mother dropped out in the 10th grade. But my mother and father, and my mother in particular, was very determined that the four of us would not make those mistakes and would all end up with college educations, and all four of us have at least bachelor's degrees.
So it's kind of interesting to know what was going through your mind, say, as a junior, when it wasn't likely that you were going to get a scholarship, how you thought you were going to manage that. What was the plan?
The plan then was that I was probably going to have to work and go to school.
Start out, maybe go to community college. And
Then in the mid-70s, community college really wasn't an entity in South Carolina.
Yeah.
you know. So I grew up in Columbia, so the University of South Carolina main campus is there, so that probably would have been the approach, but I'm not sure I would have been able to balance work and school very well.
Well, how about balancing basketball when you're there on a scholarship? That's they expect something of you, right?
Yeah, it's pretty demanding. You know, it's like I tell people, I ended up taking a lot of 8, 9 o'clock classes in the morning because every afternoon was full with, you know, activities and practice from early to mid-October until March.
And that team had the same kind of trajectory as your high school team, did it not, or do I have that wrong?
Well, it actually did not get to the point of, relatively speaking, that my high school team did. But we did go from being a 5-20 team, and then my senior year, we made it to the small college national playoffs. We lost in the first round.
So did it have an impact on you? I mean, it's hard to know. It's hard to compare what it would have been like otherwise. But what impact do you think it had on your academic career in those 4 years? Were you able to study? You feel
well,
like you got
you know, I was probably unusual in the sense that I was an athlete who spent a reasonable amount of time studying and investing in classes and doing all that and kind of keeping the other distractions at bay and thinking about what I was doing as an opportunity, knowing probably by my sophomore year of college that I was going to do some sort of, you know, post-bachelor level training of some sort. I would go to graduate school or something. So I graduated with a 3.8 GPA, which was pretty unusual, a magna cum laude.
Were you ever expecting at any point along the way to get into the NBA?
No. I wasn't good enough to get into the NBA. There were times that there were some kind of peripheral discussions about playing in Europe, but playing in Europe at that point in time was essentially $10,000 a year, and they would pay for your living expenses.
Cool place to be poor, though.
So, absolutely.
So what? So now you are you finished? You've got through 4 years, and you decide on psychology. What led you to psychology?
Well, I actually decided to major in psychology as an undergraduate. I wasn't sure whether I was going to end up in law school or in graduate school. I decided my summer after my senior year in college, I worked at a summer camp for emotionally disturbed children in South Carolina that was funded by the State Department of Mental Health and was a residential camp that recruited undergraduates from around the Southeast to serve as counselors. So that was really kind of the stealing experience that got me interested in kids and got me interested in clinical psychology.
You also had an interesting experience with Strom Thurmond. Was that camp?
Yeah. So what happened is I was a counselor as an undergraduate. When I went to graduate school, I ended up being one of the directors of the camp. And we had an experience where what we would do year to year is recruit children to come into camp. And they would be recruited from around the state. We recruit counselors and then work really hard, get everything set up and get it going. About a week before the camp was supposed to be in 1 year, Strom Thurmond called us and asked us to help him with a constituent. We obviously did that and got this child, or a child of a constituent, and got the child into the camp that summer. It was a pretty successful experience. The next year, the South Carolina Department of Mental Health was going to eliminate the program. And so we, as connected people, called up Strom Thurmond's office. And Strom Thurmond arranged for a special presentation in front of the Appropriations Committee, and we received the largest amount of funding that year that we had ever had.
I mean, that is a great insight into just the way politics works. People assume that it's all cynical and that power gets, you know, connected people what they want, but then it turns around and it has this other effect. Was that a lesson for you, or is that something that that's kind of how you expected the system to work?
Well, I think it was a positive lesson. I think that's kind of what you're saying, that there are many things that happen in the world of politics that don't necessarily come out in the media that are very positive things that work to help people and help groups of people.
What about your parents? What'd they think of your choice of psychology as a major?
I think my father in particular didn't really understand what I was trying to accomplish with going to graduate school and getting a doctorate until after I'd gotten out in the world and got a job and did all those kinds of things. I think my mother was generally supportive of whatever my choices are going to be.
Because that's the thing. Everybody's working hard. They're working very hard to see to it that you go to school, you go. But now you're looking to not necessarily pay those loans back anytime soon.
Right.
Have any other choices? So then you did that for a while. You went into clinical psychology.
Right.
Did you like it? Was it what you expected?
Well, I was a pediatric psychologist by kind of specialization area. So I really liked it. At first, after I finished my training, I was a faculty member at Auburn for a couple of years and did some practice on the side. And then I was a faculty member at the University of Maryland School of Medicine for 10 years, where I practiced there as well as outside the university and did research and teaching as well. I liked it. Did a lot of training of folks and did a lot of work with different individuals. And, it was a pretty rewarding part of my career.
Which did you prefer one over the other, the clinical practice to research or the other way around?
I always at that point in time liked a mix of things, being involved in a mix of things.
Yeah, it's probably a good way to test some of those theories, too, if you sort of actually have a practice and then you go in.
Yeah. And I was involved in some development of programs in the community. So, for example, for several years, I helped to develop and ran a healthcare program for homeless children and their families in Baltimore. And it was not direct clinical service. It wasn't research. It was developing a program to help a needy group in the community.
On the State of Things today, talking with Wayne Holden, the CEO of RTI International. Our conversation will continue after a short break on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with Wayne Holden today, CEO of RTI International. So you talking about your career and how it's coming together, you decided then to do some clinical practice, a little bit of research, and then teach. You found yourself a position in the academy. Tell us about that.
The traditional training for a PhD in clinical psychology or pediatric psychology is for people to look at working within academia and developing other things while you're there is kind of the model of where you should go. So that's kind of what I did the first 12 years of my career. And I got tenured, was successful. Everything worked out really well, doing the things that I needed to do. What happened is I eventually got to a point where the combination of things happened to me, but it was the politics of working in a big academic bureaucracy. Part of it. Part of it was I kind of became a 40-year-old person and realized I'd either been a student or a faculty member my whole life. Just decided at that point in time that it was a time when I should look to try to do some other things.
And what'd you do?
Well, I left academia and I did it in a way that most people don't in that position. Most people in that position, if they were going to leave and do something else, they would take a formal leave of absence for a year or two, so they always had the cushion to go back if they wanted to. I didn't do that. I just left, resigned.
Why?
Had another job offer. Mm-hmm. Wanted to live in another part of the country, back in the Southeast. Had an opportunity to do something that sounded like it would be challenging yet fun.
But you could have left yourself that cushion and still taken the job, right?
Yeah, I could have.
Yeah.
But
I mean, did you, it seems like it's possible you felt it was necessary to really, in your own mind, make that break or no? To make
probably,
sure.
Part of it was wanting to push myself.
Yeah.
Part of it was, wanting to make sure that I looked around at possibly leaving where I was at and moving to another academic setting. But it just didn't seem like it was moving forward in life.
Yeah. You can guess that if you went into it knowing you could go back, there'd be an astute, particularly someone who knew something about psychology, might realize that there'd be a little, it might be tentative. The way you approach the new job might not be wholesale, and maybe you needed to do that to yourself.
That's possible. I mean, I have an interesting story about the whole thing. So I left. I went to a for-profit consulting firm that does work that's similar to a reasonable amount of work that's done at RTI. And I took on some very difficult projects that, to some extent, were out of control in children's mental health services and evaluation of those. About a month into the job, I was sitting in my bedroom one night, sitting in my bed with my wife and commiserating and saying, I left a tenured position to do this and how terrible things were and it was really hard and things like that. And she just looked at me and started laughing and said, most people don't know what tenure is, and you just need to get with it and go on with the world.
Oh. What was it that was so terrible about it in that in those first few months?
It was just a very large, multiple millions of dollar project with lots of problems with delivery to the federal government. And I came into it and had to straighten all that out.
Was there anything in the academy or in basketball or anything else that you had done that prepared you for this new line of work?
Well, I mean, the things that I did were coming into it were focusing on the team that was there, trying to support everybody and get everybody to work at their highest level, to work together, to collaborate. I also kind of one of the first things was that there was an annual report to Congress that was late, and I jumped in with everybody else and wrote significant portions of the annual report to Congress that year. And you know, did not try to take a perspective of I was a leader and I would be separated and just directing people. I was also going to do a chunk of the work.
Did it turn around for you, or when did it turn around? When did you stop having buyer's remorse?
Yeah, it took about hard work for about a year. And got to the point where I felt like I had transitioned into the environment. I had figured out how to get to a level of mastery of what I was doing, where I thought things were working reasonably well.
Tell us about RTI then. It goes back to 1958, right?
So RTI was the first organization in Research Triangle Park. The concept was to establish a not-for-profit research institute as kind of the first step. It was established through a $500,000 grant, which it's unclear where exactly those resources came from. The state claims that it was the state. The business leaders who were involved claims it were the business leaders. The universities claim it was the universities. And we were founded to basically provide another environment outside of the universities for conducting research where people could work and have careers. And we grew from essentially nothing at that point to last year we had 1,500 or so projects and about $780 million in revenue.
What was that first project or those first projects?
The first sets of projects were statistical projects and lab science projects.
And, of course, this is a unique environment. I mean, we talk about it all the time, the idea that you have universities here, and of course, RTP was just in its infancy at the time. But those businesses and these research institutions being in one place is how a place like RTP mm-hmm. comes together and why RTI fits there, I guess.
Right, yeah. And at this point in time, you know, between RTI and the three universities, the amount of R&D expenditures each year across those four organizations is close to $3 billion a year. And if you look at the RTP region generally, it rates pretty high as a nexus for innovation, creativity, science, and research internationally, given all the commercial organizations, the universities, the not-for-profit organizations that are there. So it's really a very rich environment that now is trying to get a little more interconnected because the way it developed across time, part of that was the way RTP was set up. It was individual organizations rather than setting up the types of places and the context that would promote more networking.
How has the digital age changed all of that? It seems to me that since we can do everything online and bring all these people and resources and institutions together, do we need a geographic location anymore? How important is that?
Well, you know, it has, and it's made things more efficient. It also has its drawbacks. And I firmly believe that even though we have telecommunications and IT capacity that we never would have dreamed of 20 years ago, that the interpersonal component of people meeting each other and working with each other directly is also is and will continue to be extremely important to creative solutions and getting things done.
You are now the CEO of an organization that has 4,000 employees. How many here in RTP?
We've got about 2,200 in RTP. Yeah. We've got about another 600 in offices around the U.S., and then we've got about 1,200 out in the 40 or 50 countries that we're working in, working on projects. And those 1,200 are what are called in-country nationals, which means they are folks who are citizens of other countries who are working on projects there.
So does it help to know something about psychology when you run an organization that big?
Sure does.
How does that work?
How does that work?
Yeah.
Well, I think that what has helped me across time is listening, being a good observer, trying to understand people, trying to help people to maximize what they're interested in, but also helping them to understand others and work together collaboratively.
Some of the research you're doing is really in the area of development work in developing countries, capacity building, society building in Iraq, deciding how to build democracy. Let's talk about that project for one. What's going on in Iraq?
Yeah, the Iraq Local Governance Project was awarded to RTI originally in 2003. We actually, at this point in time, are finishing up some work there, small amounts of work. But it was one of the relatively successful aid projects that was done in Iraq, where we were building local governance structures, not central governance, around democratic functions and supply of services to individuals and to communities. We also had a series of other projects that were related to that, a larger project in the area of health. We're continuing to do some work in education there.
How much of that is based on research and how much of that is based on a kind of an expertise? In other words, you go in and say, here's how you do it. Or do you have to go into Iraq and say, let's find out what's going on here so we can build a more sustainable, here's how you do it?
So as a research institute, we're an evidence-based organization. So whatever we do, there has to be an evidence base to it in terms of the decision-making. And we do monitoring and looking at outcomes in any project. Now, those projects are more international development projects with strong technical assistance components, but they're based in the evidence that's available for setting them up, the best possible evidence, and then ongoing monitoring and evaluation in terms of data that you can look at for making appropriate decisions as you develop things across time.
So you go in having looked at the research that's already been done, and then how much of that, and maybe you just answered that, but is based on ascertainment on the ground, kind of what is the culture here? What's the politics? Mm-hmm. Look, here's the theory, but here's what happens in Iraq. How much of that do you have to ascertain from the ground by yourself before you go in? In other words, original research.
Well, there's a good bit of that that we do. And so a lot of that we'll even do before we write a proposal as we're trying to understand a particular country. And we were just involved in submitting a proposal to the Australian Agency for International Development and spent a good bit of time understanding some of the parameters in the context of the country that they were going to provide the funding to develop the knowledge sector there. And so we did our own kind of understanding of that and collecting information and trying to figure out what the parameters are driving that forward. And then in the proposal, proposed a fairly rigorous program evaluation once you get on the ground to monitor what you're doing and to make effective decisions about it.
How do you find it works with when you work with governments, either the local governments or, you know, the United States government? If it came from USAID, they have an agenda too. I mean, it's one thing to have evidence and say, here's how it works. And sometimes for political reasons, people don't want to hear the evidence, turns out.
Well, first of all, we are an objective, independent, nonpartisan organization. And we make that pretty clear to people right up front. What we're doing is we're driving things based on the best possible evidence, the best possible science, and objective decision-making about things. But you are right. The practicalities of working with a client sometimes can create a situation where your client wants you to do one thing and we think that we should do another thing. Usually what we do is we have significant discussions and determine what the best course of action will be based on those discussions.
Have you ever had to walk away from a project and say, look, we're just, this isn't going to work?
Yes, I have had to do that. And it was personally, in terms of running projects, I haven't run projects since I've come to RTI. I've been there for 7 years, but in the previous organization I was with, where it was pretty clear that the funder had prematurely funded this project and the outcome was not, you couldn't do the project. Once we were awarded the funding and tried to understand it a little bit better, and then just gave the resources back to the funder and moved on.
How about if you find out that they have an agenda that they want the report to come out a certain way, and you say, look, guys, that's not how we play our game?
Well, again, it's a process of discussion and collaboration, and you know, we are an independent, objective, nonpartisan group, and we're going to call things the way that we see them from the best possible science that we've done.
And part of it, too, is the logistics. You don't think about this all the time, but you're a research organization. You're going in to do a development project to a place like Iraq. RTI had the problem of having to hire a security group in Iraq. That group was a private security group, one of the ones that got tied up in the whole scandal of private security groups, and it killed some civilians. I mean, you're not in the business of security. You have to hire somebody to do that. That's one of the challenges, it seems to me, of trying to get this work done, all the stuff that isn't part of your core mission.
Yeah, well, and that's a particular challenge if you're going into what are called post-conflict zones of the world and beginning to try to do work in post-conflict zones. And certainly Iraq and Afghanistan are probably the best examples of that and some of the issues that you confront. But there are other countries where it's less about the wars like we have in Iraq and Afghanistan, more about internal conflict and strife that you have to address.
What have you learned about building democracy or local leadership, local governance in Iraq?
Well, I think what we've learned more than anything is that working with people to try to increase long-term capabilities that are going to stay in that particular context and help them significantly is really critical and important. I think the Agency for International Development in the U.S. is focused more and more on that across time, which means involving local organizations very intimately in what you're doing and helping them to build the capacity to move forward.
Isn't there a certain amount of anxiety about how many of these institutions and structures remain if once the U.S. is out altogether? Do people sort of have to have a foot in both camps?
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's a balance between having fairly sophisticated and very skilled organizations who have been doing things for a long time continue to have relationships so that they can support development across time and growing the capabilities internally. And it's a very dynamic balance across time, but I think you need to maintain a balance.
So just to give you an idea of the breadth of the projects that RTI takes on, you're also designing cigarette warning labels, right?
Yes.
Tell us about those and how you got into it.
That was work that we did for the FDA where we did qualitative research to try to look at what would be the most effective graphic warning labels that would be displayed on cigarette packs in the United States, and did some fairly intensive work for several years to help the FDA to make that determination.
What did you come up with?
We came up with some fairly graphic pictures that would be put on cigarette packs, and there are some legal issues going on now about whether the FDA is going to be able to move forward with that in the way that they would like to from a regulatory perspective.
Now, how do you do that research? How do you know that you've got the right image or one that's likely to work?
Well, the research you do is you involve communication scientists who sit down and do a lot of the preliminary work around creatively producing these things around different parameters, and then you use a structured methodology to set up your warning labels and then go out and test them with groups out in communities. And usually it starts with focus groups, and then it moves to more rigorous kinds of data that you collect from individuals.
I mean, it's always an interesting question, especially when you're talking about it. We've had this conversation about how to prevent youth, you know, kids from smoking. And the fact is they're at an age where they dare you to take their life. That's precisely the image they want among their peers, to show the death-defying youth. And so I just wonder, to what extent is it counterintuitive? Do you run into that and say, well, it works for kids, but it doesn't work for adults or something like that?
Well, we've had some pretty interesting research that we've done with youth tobacco prevention. In fact, we have contracts with about half a dozen states around the country for working on tobacco prevention, tobacco control issues. Part of it's developing communication strategies. Part of it's evaluating those. And the Truth Campaign, which was a national campaign, we found out some very interesting things being involved in research on that about how messages need to be framed differently for youth to be effective. And mostly the focus, which is an important focus, is to prevent initiation. Because once you initiate smoking, nicotine is a very addictive substance, as we all know.
And are those different messages because of age and generation, or is it because of your experience with smoking? Do you approach someone addicted in a different way than you would someone who's not yet?
Well, I think it's both. I think there's developmental issues. So you're going to approach a teenager differently than you're going to approach someone in their 30s. And then I think you're also going to change the message and make it different based on those who are you're trying to prevent initiation versus those who are ongoing smokers.
On the State of Things today, my guest, Wayne Holden, CEO of RTI International, a research and development organization headquartered in RTP here in Durham. Coming up after a short break, what the future holds for RTI. Stay with us on the State of Things. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest this hour, Wayne Holden, CEO of RTI International. We're talking about some of the projects and the many and varied projects of RTI. You're also putting together, or maybe you finished, a graphic novel, and this is for Navy personnel about to be deployed in war zones, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. So what we determined across time is that for standard personnel in the military, one of the best ways of presenting material and training material is to use graphics that are kind of like an extensive comic book in some ways. That tells a story about what it's like out on the battlefield. And actually, that particular novel, which started out in a print version, is now electronic. And you can access it electronically, and it's a little more interactive. And we've expanded that beyond the Navy into some of the other armed services as a part of what is a larger group of things that we do around pre-deployment inoculation to help individuals to have a better understanding and clearer understanding of what they're going to confront once they're deployed.
You know, the military has been at this kind of thing, it seems to me, for a long time. How much do you learn from them, and how much of what they were doing was okay, and how much has to be remodeled and changed?
Well, I think we learn a reasonable amount from them. I think what we help them do is to take more sophisticated communications and technology strategies and embed that within what they're doing, and to make it fit more specifically with the younger generation that they're dealing with, who yep. is the generation who grew up with the internet and being connected.
Although you would think, I mean, since that's the bulk of their, certainly their recruits are coming from that generation, they'd be pretty savvy to that group. They know a little bit about what's going on. I mean, and so how much do you learn from, do you take from their research? And this is what I want to know is if you just sort of, if you look at what they've done, because they've been in psychological operations for a long time, not only in terms of helping indoctrinate their own personnel, but also when they get into the war zones. How much of that is available and how much of that is useful still?
No, a lot of it's available. A lot of it's useful. Actually, the Department of Defense has had a pretty strong emphasis on trying to build training for personnel and healthcare across time. And the way that they've done that, which is laudable, is that they outsource a lot of this and have contracts with other organizations who can bring in their level of expertise to try to help them rather than building a set of people internally that becomes a fairly expensive operation to maintain.
You know, another project that you're involved in is interesting to me as well, and this is uranium mining near Danville, Pennsylvania, and sort of looking at some of the safety side of this and then the economic side of it. Tell us about the project.
So this is a project where we were brought in to provide an environmental assessment and economic assessment to the potential issues of establishing a uranium mine near Danville. And we approached it in a fairly comprehensive fashion, and we looked at the issues of what are some of the environmental issues, but also what are the economic issues, both in terms of the cost to the community, but as well as the benefits to the community, in terms of a new employer coming into town and what some of the issues would be associated with that, and provided it to the a foundation in Danville who was set up to address some of these issues.
What did you find?
Well, I think we found that the environmental issues are things that with specific recommendations could be mitigated and contained across time. But there are environmental issues, obviously, and they're relatively long-term issues across time. But what we also found is that there were significant economic benefits in terms of employment and opportunities for individuals in an area that struggle some to be able to provide those kinds of things.
Yeah, this seems to me the most difficult kind of research, because obviously jobs are important to people. Then the question is what kind of jobs, national security issues when you're talking about uranium, and then, of course, environmental issues where, you know, we're just not sure how long it will take or what, you know, what's at stake. When you do a project like that, is each of those questions in its own silo, or is there any attempt to sort of average them and say, on the whole, you know, it comes out more likely, better for you to do it than not to do it?
Well, I think we present the information objectively, so we present it in different ways, and we'll present it in terms of the silos, but we'll also try to present an overall picture and then you know, let the organization that's asked us to do the work make the final decisions about the direction they'd like to go in.
What about RTI itself as an organization engaged in all these projects? We haven't even talked about biotech, right? You do all kinds of testing in biotechnology as well. Mm-hmm. So pharmaceutical companies are interested in your work. And you develop products, I understand. There's a catheter that you're working on that will help give surgeons a better view of what they're looking at, what they're going into. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And how much of that goes on, actual product development?
Well, relatively speaking, it's a small amount. Relatively speaking, given that most of what we do is projects that are funded externally that come in. But over the last 10 or 15 years, especially with the previous CEO, Victoria Haynes, RTI moved more in that direction. And we have a couple of spin-out companies that have taken technology, and we've worked with other investors to try to take that outside of RTI and develop that. And we have several different mechanisms internally for identifying products we could move down the commercialization path and begin to develop across time. None of those internally at this point in time have blossomed into huge activities for us.
With all of these activities and projects going on, is there much communication? How much do these projects inform each other, and how much maybe is it your job to make sure they're not talking to each other in some ways?
Well, that's one of the challenges of having a large organization. And, you know, too often in large organizations, what happens is you have meetings and people start talking to each other and they realize they're doing work that could intersect and help each other, but they sit in different parts of the organization. So you have to constantly try to work on that and try to bring together folks to do that. We have people, for example, in international development who are working in energy development internationally at a different level in developing countries. We have people who are doing very complex technology-oriented energy work in the U.S. My job in terms of being in a leadership position is to try to bring those people together so that they can understand each other's context where they're working and try to help each other.
It seems to me, too, with all these various projects growing as it did from, what did you say, $500,000, the initial grant in 1958, that the mission itself, what is the mission and how does that sort of, how do you keep that contained or defined, or is there a need to?
So our mission is improving the human condition through turning knowledge into practice. That's a very broad, very wide mission.
That's our mission, too, by the way. Yeah. I like that. That is now our mission. Thank you. We've got one down. Did you get that, Lindsay? That's our new mission. Forgive me. Go ahead.
But you're absolutely right. It's very broad, very wide. There's lots of things that can fit into it. There are a few things that don't fit into it. So obviously, we're not going to get involved in developing weapon systems. That doesn't improve the human condition by turning knowledge into practice. So part of the challenges for us as we move ahead into the future is to try to figure out what are some more specific focuses within that mission that we can dedicate ourselves to over the next 10 or 15 years. Can we, across the board from our lab scientists to our people who are out in the field putting health and education programs in place in the developing world, can we dedicate ourselves and say we're interested in solving this particular important problem in the next 10 to 15 years, to eradicating this particular disease entity, to making a major discovery and a major contribution in this particular area? Not that that's the only thing that we do, but that it provides us with some points of focus within the context of the overall mission.
Well, how much of that comes at your initiative and how much of that is just in response to seeing where the funding is? Where is the, you know, what is USAID interested in these days?
Well, so that's an interesting issue because when you talk about funding now, you have to think about, well, is funding changing? You know, we're an organization that this year is 85% funded by U.S. federal government. Now, when I say that to people, they often get the look on their face that you've got on your face. Which is concern about what's going to happen in the future.
Yeah.
So we've been very good and very successful as an organization working with the U.S. federal government. But we may very well be entering a period of time where the monolithic U.S. federal government funder of these types of activities changes. It's especially important, I think, during that point in time to try to be more disciplined and more focused about what you're going to do and where you're going to head and develop the things that you're going to do with multiple sources of funding from multiple places. And the way to do that is to, you know, get behind particular issues that you're trying to drive and achievements that you're interested in getting to you and your staff over a course of a long period of time.
But does that mean that an organization like RTI takes the initiative and points out the problem and doesn't wait for the NGO or the government to come to them and say malaria is our issue and AIDS
absolutely.
Is our issue?
No, absolutely. Although malaria could be an issue. You could say malaria is an important issue. What we've done in malaria, for example, up until now, is we're very good at on the grounds, what's called indoor residual spraying in the developing world, in sub-Saharan Africa. But what we don't have is we don't have people all the way back in our chain to our lab scientists working on particular issues regarding malaria and the people who are doing work in between. So one thing that focus can provide for organizations is kind of get everybody collaborating and working together.
On big issues that people already say they care about, things like AIDS. And,
right.
And in terms of developing drugs, that's kind of the other big issue, something that you all are involved in, at least in terms of testing. And, of course, the great concern is that these drugs are coming to market too soon, that drug companies really have too much control. Some would complain over the testing process and that the FDA isn't big enough. We don't have enough outside oversight looking at this process.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we have a very well-developed system in the U.S. for regulating the issue of drugs and drug development. With science and technology changes that will be occurring in the next 10 to 20 years, that's probably going to undergo some changes as well. But I think the changes and the promise is that we can be more efficient and we probably can get to a point where we can accelerate the process beyond where we sit currently. If we utilize all those things very effectively and efficiently.
Well, how would that look? Because the other side of that complaint is it takes too long for drugs to come to market, and you hear that, and it's very expensive to develop these things, and yet you certainly don't want them on the market and not being safe. And with the press, with the push to deregulate, to take government out of the process, how would that happen? What would be the oversight and regulation with so much commercial pressure to produce and so much political pressure to reduce mm-hmm. government oversight?
Well, I think if you can take – so I'll give you an example of something we're working on. We're working on a project called a lung on a chip, which basically allows you to take lung cells and create through an engineering technology a mini lab to put them in and to be able to do experiments looking at toxic response to different substances, which is a big component of – the development of medications, safety and toxicity levels, and making sure that they're safe and making sure that they're dosed at the right levels so that you don't have toxicity associated with that. Up until now, the way that you would approach that is by doing fairly expensive animal studies, which may or may not directly translate into human tissues. So developing more in vitro approaches that combine engineering and combine that with basic lab sciences and microbiology and chemistry and being able to take what are now very sophisticated biological assays offers a promise for us to be able to do much more in a comprehensive way at a lower cost point.
Do you see RTI becoming a greater involvement in developing actual product lines as a way to there's another revenue stream, another way to make money?
Yeah, I think that our challenge as we move into the future is to continue to be, a very competitive and a very good partner with the U.S. federal government. But it's also to diversify what we're doing and diversify into other partnerships and other funding streams.
So I'm assuming you're happy in the new job, but are you also, as part of you, how big a part of you would just love to be back in a clinic working with kids?
I'm happy in my new job. I appreciate you saying that. I periodically, think about that and think about doing things like that. I spend an awful lot of time with my 3.5-year-old grandson, so that helps me to spend time with a developing kid who's pretty young, who's fun to be around. But I'm sure at some point in the future I'll do more with kids. What I do now is I sit on some not-for-profit boards and provide some input regarding children's services, and I've worked some with the homeless community in Durham and some of the groups that work with them to try to stay invested and involved.
Can you imagine? And by the way, as a grandfather, as you know, you're not really responsible for that child's emotional well-being anymore, right? You don't really. It doesn't really matter anymore. It's up to the parents. But so, have you thought about? Is it something that you'd want to do as you retire? In retirement, get back into more clinical work?
Yeah, it's something that I might want to consider as I get older. I did let my licensure expire as a psychologist when I moved to North Carolina. I have maintained adjunct positions at universities since I left academia. And when I was in Atlanta for 7 years, I was an adjunct at Emory, and I actually did supervision. I didn't do direct clinical service work.
Could you think of getting back into the academy? Would you teach again?
I would teach, but I would enjoy doing that as kind of a part-time, in-and-out kind of thing rather than being, you know, full-time in academia.
And the universities now are really making a push toward entrepreneurship, certainly at UNC, but I think at Duke and State as well. All of them are sort of trying to marry the entrepreneurial side with the academic side. Do you think that? How much of that do you think is just being part of this environment here and having RTP, having been here for so many decades?
Yeah, I think part of it's the environment. I think part of it is the pressures being placed on higher education. And where higher education is going in the future in terms of productivity and efficiency. We as an organization have a unique opportunity and have continued to work on that and plan to expand it in the future in terms of our collaboration with the three founding universities that were involved in getting us up and running over 50 years ago and still sit on our board and work collaboratively with us. And I think the opportunity for all of us to work together as we move ahead and what at one level is more challenging times, but at another level probably provides some interesting opportunities for growth, is going to be really pretty exciting.
Wayne, good to talk with you. Thanks so much for being in the program.
Thank you.
Wayne Holden, CEO of RTI International. And that's the state of things for today. Thanks for listening. This is North Carolina Public Radio, the broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.